Welcome to Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast. I'm your host, Elizabeth Moran, Editorial Director of Fixed Income News Australia. Join me as I talk about the latest news, views and education in fixed income investment. I'll be joined by industry experts from Australia and across the globe. Hello, today we have Senior Economist Janu Chan, who is author of the excellent Bite-Sized Economics publication. She was previously a Senior Economist with Westpac and she resides in Hong Kong. So I'm really looking forward to her global insights. Welcome, Janu.
Thanks, Liz. Really glad to be on your podcast and thanks for the invitation.
Oh, our pleasure. So there's a lot of mixed sentiment about at the moment. What do you think will happen to global interest rates this year? And do you have a view on the US Fed's path?
It has been extremely mixed. I think at the moment there's not a real clear indication of where things are going. I found it really interesting how this time last year, the consensus forecast was the world's heading into recession and there was a general consensus view that that was going to happen. This time around, there isn't that same consensus. There's views all over the place with what might happen. And I think that's a reflection of some ongoing optimism from last year. Look, we didn't hit a recession. There is more likely to be a chance of that soft landing that the Fed had hoped for. But at the same time, a lot of those risks that were present last year are still here. We still have interest rates at quite high levels and we don't know what that could translate to. It was last year that we, as a result of high interest rates, that we saw the regional banks in the US fail and the Fed stepping in with a funding program. So I don't think that we can rest easy, but at the same time, look, maybe the Fed will achieve this soft landing that they hope for. So, and I think when that comes to the Fed's path and interest rates, there's still a lot of uncertainty there. At the moment, there's a lot of rate cuts now priced in and a lot of talk about the Fed cutting rates later this year. I think that's overblown. I even think that the Fed's optimistic in what they expect Fed rate cuts to be. And that's as a result of that resilience in the US economy. And I think we could continue to see that throughout this year. And I suspect the Fed will err on the side of caution of leaving rates higher rather than cut them too early.
I totally agree. I can't believe that some commentators are talking about six cuts this year, which just seems like crazy. And, you know, all that optimism in the market, I think people are spending still and, you know, they're hopeful for that outcome. But whether they can pull it off, and that actually might mean they have to just keep rates higher for longer again.
That's right. It's amazing how quickly that's turned around. I mean, it wasn't very long ago. There was still some fear that the Fed could hike even one more time. And, look, I think a big part of that is just how fast inflation has come down. I think that's caught a lot of people off guard. You have the transitory inflation camp, which now saying, look, we're right, but at the same time, there is that likelihood that we could see some more persistent inflation. Yes, to some extent, inflation was transitory thanks to the supply constraints easing, that post-pandemic demand surge coming off. But if you do, I am of the belief, though, if you have an economy running at close to capacity, you still have a very low unemployment rate in the US. I think with most of the supply constraints easing off, We could still see some persistent supply constraints. I mean, what's going on in the Red Sea is one example of just how easily supply can be disrupted because we're in a much more uncertain world. The risk of some sort of conflict rising globally and disrupting supply, I think that remains as well. So, yeah, look, inflation is going to be that key point. I suspect that optimism comes from inflation coming much further, like back to 2%, very easily. And I'm not so convinced that that's going to happen.
No, neither am I. I'm in your camp. So here's a good question for you. Hard or soft landing?
Can I say no landing still?
Yes. That's a good answer.
Yeah, I'm going to say no landing because I'm not sure if we're even at that point where we've landed. And I think there's a risk we may not see evidence of a so-called landing till towards the end of this year, or maybe not even this year. I think, you know, the longer that rates stay high as well, there is that bigger risk that you do get the hard landing. Again, this comes back to that story about inflation. Do you think that there is something more persistent there, or is that done and dusted? That was just a COVID thing. We're going back to the way we were. I don't think that's the case because I think the world is a different place. I think that this emphasis that the governments are shifting towards, you know, securing supply chains rather than efficiency, that's something that's more persistent. That's a structural kind of change. And so I suspect that we do have some elements of persistent inflation, even though some of it's in transitory, and that increases that risk that we do still see some sort of hard landing. That I don't think we'll get real evidence of that until much later this year.
So, like, thinking a soft landing's like an ideal outcome, what would it take for that to happen, do you think?
Yeah, the soft landing, you see this immaculate disinflation continue, I think. You also don't see any other risks emerge that would lead to some sort of stresses in the financial system. You would also have to see not too much disruption in the world. So perhaps some, you know, the Middle East tensions easing, and that kind of thing. I think you need a confluence of really optimistic outcomes for the soft landing outcome to be realized. It's not out of the question. You could also see, I think, demand weaken enough, but not to a significant point that's enough for inflation to slowly ease gradually, and demand weak enough that any sort of supply constraints aren't going to be too disruptive, because demand has weakened off. So I think one of the things I've been trying to emphasize in this past year is that you can't have inflation fall rapidly back towards target and not have demand also weaken. I don't subscribe to that. I don't think we're in a case where you can continue to have the best of both worlds.
That's great. I agree. What could go wrong? I mean, there's a multitude of things that could go wrong. Middle East escalates, oil price goes through the roof, increasing distribution costs. But what else do you see that could go wrong? Maybe that your worst case, most likely case scenario type thing.
I think the biggest risk in the world now is absolutely the geopolitical climate. And there's quite a few elections this year, the US being the obvious one, and the UK as well. And we just had Taiwan. Markets are watching these closely because they have the potential to shift the geopolitical landscape quite significantly. I think the point of what could go wrong comes back to, well, what about the conflicts that we're not, which could emerge that we're not quite aware of? Look, Ukraine and is still going on. The US and the rest of the West are, they're not all in either, like in terms of, providing that aid to Ukraine. Like I think there's very long delays in that aid, and that's worked to Russia's favor. Look, and that war is still going on. And I think that speaks to how the world is approached, like the world leaders around the world might approach war and conflict. I mean, it's just reading this morning about North Korea risks potentially escalating, and that there has been quite a shift in the sentiment in there. So I think that's something that is the unknown, which could go wrong as the biggest risk. But yeah, I think the global geopolitical tensions is probably my biggest concern.
So how do you see US actions or US, the Fed path, influencing the rest of the world? If they start cutting, will that force everyone else to start thinking about it? How does that play out in your mind?
I think it's more that the dynamics in the US is just a similar scenario in other countries like Australia. So if there is that element of, we all had the pandemic. We all had supply can significantly constrained because that was a global phenomenon. But there was also a commonality in providing significant stimulus to these economies as well to support households. So, in a sense, that policy action has been done in a similar way. They've responded in a similar way in how dealing with the pandemic and the aftermath. And so I think other central banks are in a similar boat in just discovering what to do. So I think reason why you'll see some, if the US cuts, then maybe it is more likely that other parts of the world will cut. In saying that, because the US economy is so resilient, I suspect you'll see more of an argument for cuts in, say, Europe for sure. And so, for example, Japan's on a completely other path. And for Australia, I think maybe it does play a part in how it's shaped inflation, in the story behind inflation and what's been driving it. Perhaps if we do see the US cut earlier than I expect or what the market's expecting, then I would see an argument to say, look, maybe the inflation dynamics in Australia might have a similar tone to it. And that could bring forward expectations for rate cuts in Australia. But, Australia also has some tax cuts coming in. So I suspect that's going to keep the RBA a little wary, and that cycle of inflation has lagged what's been happening in the rest of the world too. It's coming down now, coming down quite quickly, but we're a couple of steps behind where inflation has been in the US.
Definitely. As you're based in Asia, how do you see China's ongoing property market woes and the Chinese economy generally impacting global growth? And do you have any Asia Pacific insights that you'd like to share, because we'd find that really, really invaluable?
Yeah, the property market problems are going to be around for quite a long time. There's just a huge amount of unfinished inventory that is just sitting there, and the way that China works if there is a major risk to financial stability, they're not going to go down that path. And that what they need to, because what you need to clear inventory is some pretty significant price falls. But because of that risk to financial stability, they don't want to, I think that's preventing them from allowing that, which means that you're going to have like this, you know, dragging on for a long, long, long time. That's been a major drag on China's economy and the household sector. I think that would continue to be the case. But I don't think we can, I think we need to be careful not to be overly pessimistic on China in a sense that we're not going to get some sort of financial collapse because they're not going to allow that. And China's, even though they're not providing huge support or handouts or stimulus to households, which I think could help a lot of problems in China, they're still providing a lot of support to investment. It's just not into the property sector anymore. It's still to infrastructure, and it's still to other sectors of the economy, like manufacturing, for example. So it's going towards different industries. And I think that's what's preventing, you know, any kind of collapse in commodity demand, for example. There's other things that are probably driving commodity demand too, but like I think that's one reason. And even though this isn't a great model for sustainable economic growth or productive investment, this is still what China's doing, and it might prevent that collapse in China's economy that, you know, some might be fearing. That doesn't mean that like we'll still see these, you know, 5% growth or even higher anymore. And I think that will gradually need to come down, because by China relying on investment continuously, I mean, as part of their growth model, more and more that's going to be unproductive and loss-making investment.
The projected birth rates are quite interesting in China. They've really fallen off, even though the government seems to be wanting people to have more than one baby. They're not. So
yeah.
That's got to impact growth longer term.
It's not one of those things where you can just tell people to have more babies and they will.
No, there's a little bit involved, isn't there?
Yeah, it's a big issue, the demographic issue, and I suspect they're aware of it. It's not an uncommon problem around the world. I mean, the thing is, like, say, for example, in Australia, they're getting a huge amount of immigration to offset any sort of aging population, and places like China, also like Japan, they're just not getting that kind of offset with their aging populations. Yeah, it's a big long-term growth challenge. I think the big thing which is interesting in Asia now is how that pessimism from China has influenced flows to everywhere else in Asia. And you can see that the rest of Asia benefiting from the trade tariffs, which, you know, with the US, so, you know, Vietnam, Thailand have been some big beneficiaries in terms of their exports and potentially investment down the track. And the other interesting part was the shift in investment flows. So I don't think it's a coincidence that the Japanese share market's done so well when the Chinese market's done so poorly. And I suspect that the other parts of Asia are increasingly benefiting from the fact that investors have been down on China and see these problems on a longer-term growth scale. So the rest of Asia is benefiting from trade flows and investment flows.
It's a really great insight, really interesting. I don't get that sense here, but very interesting. So just recently, the International Monetary Fund reported on Australia, suggesting that rates here will be on hold this year. We've talked a little bit about how you see inflation and rates here, but what do you think? Do you think that's, I mean, it's obviously there's this broad range of commentary and alternative scenarios. You have any views on that?
Yeah, I don't disagree with that view. I think that for one, inflation it is still a bit higher than elsewhere in the world, in, say, for example, US, because just the inflation dynamics has just been a bit later than everywhere else. I don't see a strong argument for rates to be cut either. Like, demand's, it's not roaring, but it's not collapsing.
I agree. So, like, just drilling down into the fixed income market, do you consider that 2024 is the year of the bond? And any thoughts you have there would be really appreciated.
I think in, because of my view on the near term, that I think the prospect of rate cuts, or the scale of rate cuts this year, is a bit overblown. I suspect you could get yields coming up a bit. Don't think they'll revisit the 5% or the 10. I don't think the 10-year will revisit the 5% level. So I suspect you'll get some, you know, yields rising up before sort of stabilizing, which does mean that you could get some potentially good opportunities to buy in. I think because...
What do you think's a good rate, Janu? When it hit 5%, I thought it was a screaming buy. You know, US Treasury's 10 years, 5%, well, who wouldn't take that? What do you think's a good rate now? Where would you be a buyer of the US 10-year?
I reckon... So I've just put out a chart here that I'm looking at. Look, I reckon 4.6 even looks good now.
Yeah.
I think that could be a good level. Yeah, it's actually incredible how far yields have come down since they hit that 5%, right?
That was only November. It's only January. It's only sort of 8 weeks later. And what is it, about 4.1, 4.2 now?
Yeah. So I think there's more room for that to come back. At the moment, you still have a huge amount of cuts priced in. And this week, the Fed is... Some of the messaging now is saying, look, take it easy. We're not considering cuts anytime soon. I think there is going to be some sort of pushback on that. Because also, this is a good example of how financial conditions have eased significantly. That's going to undermine what the Fed might want in terms of just a slow moderation in demand. I think if you get some sort of pickup in the economy, the US economy, which I think is there's a reasonable likelihood of that because of that easing in financial conditions. I think also because, you know, Q3 was such a monster quarter of growth, above 5%, that you're naturally going to get some pushback from that in the next quarter. So, and even then, it still was over 2%. Like, it was stronger than expectations.
I just think of, like, this giant cruise ship in the ocean, right? And the stimulus being a massive injection, and trying to turn it around. It's not going to turn around on a dime. It takes a lot of time, and it's slow, and it's longer than everyone expects. I mean, that's just my sort of thoughts. I agree with you.
That's a really good analogy. In the US, that transmission from tight monetary policy is slower and is not as significant immediately, just because of the reliance more on long-term funding rather than short-term funding. And so even though it's going to dramatically affect new lending, existing borrowers just they don't have to move on to a higher rate. They can just hold on to the super low rates that they got in the pandemic years and not move if they don't have to. So they don't have the same budget constraints of high interest rates, if, say, like in Australia, where a majority are on variable rates, and even the fixed rates aren't for 30 years. They're for like two, 3 years. And I think that's been a major factor in why some of the households, household spending can be a bit more resilient.
That's a really great insight. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us? We've had a great conversation, but are there any other thoughts you'd like to share with us?
So I just see a headline that the Hong Kong court has ordered a liquidation order of China Evergrande. So I think this is going to be a very interesting thing to watch, and particularly for fixed income, because Evergrande bonds have been this massive no man's land. It's been over 2 years since Evergrande first defaulted, and there's been like no progress at all, not on a restructuring, not on anything. And so what a liquidation order will do in Hong Kong for this company in China is going to be really interesting to watch out for.
Is that like a bit of a house of cards? Once it goes, other developers will come in behind it, or will China step in, do you think, the government step in?
Well, it's complicated because this is a Hong Kong court order, whereas this is China Evergrande is domiciled in the mainland. So is the Hong Kong court order going to have any impact on liquidation on assets which are held in China? That's one big question. And it has big implications for what will happen to a lot of the bonds on property in China, particularly if they haven't been able to work out some sort of restructuring deal. I think for the most part, other developers, they've been able to restructure something. But because with Evergrande, it's been a different story because the chairman, the people in charge are MIA, like the chairman's. So there's no one able to kind of, you know, organise some sort of restructure anyway. So then the next course of action is a liquidation. Like, well, so how does that bankruptcy process go about? You can also see some positives to it as well because, okay, this is what happened with Evergrande. Maybe investors can now say, okay, that's what happened. This is a possible course of action with what might happen. Rather than some of these bondholders in China thinking, okay, well, worst case scenario, they'll get, like, possible scenarios, I'll just get nothing. And then that's the expectation. That it looks like it could result in a process at least for investors.
So positive.
Potentially, because there's at least a progress rather than just being, I'm not sure what's going to happen. So, yeah, this is going to be one to watch right now.
Jenny Chan of Bite Size Economics, thank you so much for joining us today. Jenny's publication is excellent. Her articles are so well written and easy to follow, and we really thank you for allowing us to publish them on Fixed Income News Australia. Thanks so much for your time, and we hope that we might get a chance to speak to you again.
You're welcome, Liz. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us this week on Fixated, the Fixed Income podcast. Still hungry for more fixed income news, views and education? Then visit fixedincomenews.com.au and don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter to have the latest news delivered right to your inbox. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Elizabeth Moran and we'll see you next episode on Fixated, the Fixed Income podcast.